Wait, you already tagged me in this, didn't you? Oh, no, you didn't. Perfect. I can post it.
Okay. Perfect, 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 perfect. Okay. Action. All right. Today, and it's funny how life works, because I was thinking about making this a tweet thread, and I still may make it a tweet thread. I was saying, like, hey, if I still was in Shreveport right now, I'd probably be making maybe 60K max.
Oh, don't even get me started about I don't even think about it.
But
I can't relate anymore.
I'm going to tell you what drew this to me.
That would be a, that, bye.
I had a consultation today with a guy who's been doing desktop support for 10 years.
The same role?
Different roles, but pretty much the same thing. And he's, and if you hear this, I'm not going to say your name, but if you hear this, man, it's not a shot at you. This is kind of a teaching point, and hopefully we get to work again after I gave you those tips on what skills to work on and then come back to me. But I was asking him, like, yo, what do you want to make? He was like, man, to get another role, I was hoping I'd make like 60. And he's currently like being underpaid now.
He don't know, though.
That's why he reset the name. But also, just what skills people tend to have on their resume is almost relative to possibly what they make salary-wise.
Facts. And also, you can look at a resume and tell, like, about, you can gauge. You absolutely can gauge.
For sure. And, like, and that's the reason why I tell people don't stay and help desk too long, because that's what it can do to you. It could trick you.
10 years?
It could trick you of your worth. You're getting overworked and underpaid.
For 10 years. Dang.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. But he's actually in the area, so I think that's a plus. But it's just one of those things where, what were we talking about? I did the live, for people who are tuning in right now, I did the live last week with Danielle, and we were talking about how mentorship can pretty much fast-track your career.
I was just going to say the same thing about that, too, because if you don't know, social media is powerful for that very reason. You can see people moving up, moving around. You can reach out. You can make connections. You can ask questions.
Yeah, and I'm always the person that's telling people, hey, if you ain't got no kids or nothing, move to where the money is.
Move where the money is, even if you're going to go by yourself. We see our boy done did it. And he doing what he want to do.
Right. And even if you, like, so he's in the, technically he's in the Metroplex. But he's on the side where most of the jobs aren't. So one of the reasons why a lot of people, we do move out here when we say we're in Dallas. A lot of times we're not. We in McKinney. We in Plano. We in Frisco. We in Louisville. We in Carrollton.
Grand Prairie.
Yeah. So he, I think he actually works out there. But when we were looking at jobs, a lot of the more stuff that he would like to do fit was like over here. And I was like, this one of the things.
How bad do you want it? You going to commute or you going to move?
Right. And I think it also goes into, like, I was telling him too, and I've said this before, but I was like, another reason why some people don't know their worth and sometimes they get stuck or complacent is, well, actually, let me retract that. This goes into negotiating your worth. If you never make $75,000, you may not know that you can make $95,000.
No, facts. Absolutely.
Or if you never make $95,000, you don't never know that you can make $125,000.
Agreed.
And so on and so on. So I'm like, right now, if you've been at $50,000 for 10 years, somebody's tell you they pay you $65,000, you may think that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, that is most than what most people make in America, but, ever, but in our field.
But if you don't know, I've been talking about this thing that we're talking about right now for like 2 weeks with some of my friends. It's like, if you don't have people who dream big, if you don't have people around you who have hit these numbers or who have experienced or been able to do these things, you literally can't most times think bigger than that. You have to be exposed to it in some way, shape, or form for you to be like, oh, I can do that too. Or I want that for myself. Like, everybody, if we think about it, most people just wanted to make six figures. And then we found out you can make more than six figures, right? We found out that you can make over 100K. We found out that you can make 120, 50, 200, 300. So if you don't meet people who are doing these things or who are trying to do these things, you will never even think 250.
Right. And when you think about this too, most of the time in our immediate circle or our family, a lot of them that make over $40,000.
Exactly.
$25,000 a year.
was a stretch.
You had people, you know, they were good with 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, $20 an hour, mm-hmm. which you could live on back then.
Yeah. So times have changed.
Now, if you're talking about money, it may seem a little out of touch, or what you say to them may be out of touch of.
And I think that makes it. About. I think that makes it difficult too, because if you don't have anybody in your family, let's say you don't have anybody, right? You don't know anybody in the field that you're trying to get in, and also you don't have anybody in your family that you can have those conversations with when you do get the offer on. Okay, how do I negotiate, or what should I be trying to advocate for myself more? Whether it's stock, whether it's your base, whether it's, you know, the extra perks that you can get. But if you don't have people in your life who are doing these things, then you won't know that you can do these things, and you won't really know how high your ceiling can really go.
Yeah, for sure. And so that's why your network is important, meeting people. That's why with the – what's the word I want to look for? Influx. With the influx of – I know you people have been calling them influencers, but hater or love it, they've introduced you to some stuff you were not privy of 5 years ago, mm-hmm. and we're almost going on to 2026.
That's what I'm saying.
So now you can find the people online that do the things that you would like to do, and the things that you're like, well, how do I get to A to B? Right? We all know if you want to go somewhere in your car, you just put it in Google Maps, Waze, or Apple Maps. But a lot of times before this, a lot of people didn't have any maps for their career. And so early on, when you first get a new job or you're finally in corporate, that's one of the things you need to figure out is the map for my career. Who could I find that would be my mentor? And you really don't have to ask them. Like I said, if you just show up, do the work, and be likable, somebody may take you under your wing. And if they do, and if they're higher up enough, one, visibility, two, they can put you, help you get onto a team that you may not be the most qualified for, but because they got faith in you, the company will have faith in you. And it's, that's how the cycle goes a lot of times internally. Externally, it's similar. You might have to do a little bit more work to find a mentor or a coach or whatever you need to do, but at the end of the day, you have to do these things to invest in your career, because sometimes we're stuck like in the present. And then by the time we look up, it has been 10, 15 years. I'm like, man, what am I going to do?
Yep.
I shouldn't be living this way. I have a lot of experience. I have a lot of potential
or even
to do
just
more.
Desire. Like, I desire more. That's how I felt when I was at State Farm. I was like, y'all been here for how long? That's why you're angry every day. Because you need to move on. You need to move on. You're making this enjoyable for people that are not even going to be here forever. That's exactly how I feel. I was like, oh, I'm not doing this for 20 years. I'm absolutely not.
Yeah. Mm-mm. No, that's, listen, that's all facts. And if you feel like that and you're still with us right now, leave a comment in the comment section and tell us, hey, did you move away to make the bag? Or are you still in your city or like your hometown and you hadn't made the bag and you want to make the bag, but maybe life got you down with kids and everything else. I'm telling you, when there's a will, there's a way. We got plenty of guests that'll come on where they have kids and they've made a way to give their kids a better life and themselves a better life.
Yep.
Before our intro, let me go do something real quick.
Can you flip this too?
Flip what?
So I can see me?
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Now be careful.
All right.
Let's get it.
And we're back. Welcome back, everybody, to episode 195 of the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD, and we got Cyber Shorty in the building with us tonight.
Hey, y'all.
And it's been an eventful week. It's a lot of stuff that's been happening, a lot of cool stuff that we definitely want to cover today. But first and foremost, if you're listening to us in the car ride or you're going to work, please follow us on the Apple Podcast, Spotify, all the other mediums, and on YouTube. All you got to do is hit the thumbs up button. And then if you keep on listening and you like us, subscribe. But earlier we were kind of talking about complacency and kind of wanting more for your career. And it's not a chastisement. It's just a position that most people have been at before.
Yeah, and this is a position that a lot of people don't know that they're in.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those other things too. We have people like, say, like the attack on anti-intellectual. That might make that a blooper. Anti-intellectualism.
Yes.
And you always hear these people, they're ragging on a lot of people who went to school, like, oh, you went to school to only make yada, 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 yada. But you know what else school does? School start introducing you to, like, the roles that I know I could do now, I seen it on the bulletin at school.
Yeah. Yep.
And this is before I ever got into the industry. But, like I said, that was, what, 15 years ago. I'm ancient. But that's just one of the things where school can be beneficial. And no matter what school you go to, it can show you. You can go to WGU.
Oh, my God.
But I think the one of the biggest things that I wanted to get into like right away was a Cloudflare outage.
It was.
And I forget what day it was on. Was it like Tuesday?
It was.
Yeah, it was Tuesday.
On.
It was Tuesday.
Yes. It was Tuesday.
And I remember I was trying to go on X and say, hey, Post can't load at this time. Post, I was like, what? I checked my internet and everything. I was like, what's going on? And then after that, that's when I kind of did my rounds through all my other Intel resources. And I had posted them on my stories like, oh, Cloudflare was down. And so we're going to briefly talk about the incident and what they say caused it. But the Cloudflare outage. There we go. This is killing me. There we go. The Cloudflare outage. Database error takes down 20% of internet. A simple database permission change triggered a massive internet outage on November 18, 2025, knocking offline major cryptocurrency exchanges, social media platforms, and thousands of websites worldwide. This incident exposed how much of the internet depends on just a few infrastructure companies. And that is crazy when you think about how much money AWS is making. Google, Big M, Cloudflare, and it's like some others. Like, in a short amount of time, Cloudflare is like taking off.
No, they have, for sure.
So it's crazy. I'm glad I didn't get, like, I interviewed with them twice. And one of those, I probably would have been dealing with this incident. I would have been mad.
Directly.
I would have been so mad. All I'd be day. Like, bro, this ain't got nothing to do with us. At 11:20 UTC on November 18th, Cloudflare's network began experiencing widespread failures. The company, which handles about 20% of all internet traffic, suffered a complete breakdown of its core systems for nearly 3 hours. I think I'm a little hot. Let's see. There we go. The problem started with a database change at 11:05 UTC. Cloudflare was improving security on its ClickHouse and database system when something went wrong. The database began creating duplicate entries in a configuration file used by Cloudflare's bot protection system. This file grew from its normal size to more than double, breaking the software that processes internet traffic. When Cloudflare's servers tried to load this oversized file, they crashed. The file contained more than 200 features, exceeding the system's built-in limit of 200. Normal usage was around 60 features. The failure spread across the company's entire global network, affecting millions of websites that rely on Cloudflare for security, speed, and reliability. Now, interesting, because most people know around this time is when like a lot of companies go on freezes and they don't really do any changes.
Literally, it should already be in place.
Because it's the holidays and people trying to make money.
Next week is Thanksgiving.
So I'm showing like the Cloudflare tweets right here, and I may throw that up. But users trying to visit affected websites saw error 500 messages instead of normal content. The outage lasted until 14:30 UTC, when engineers manually replaced the broken file with a working version. Full service restoration was completed by 17:06 UTC. Now, that's crazy. Now, it says that the crypto industry was hit hard by this infrastructure failure. Major cryptocurrency platforms suffered significant disruptions during the outage. Popular exchanges like Coinbase, Kraken, and BitMEX became inaccessible to users. Blockchain explorers included Etherscan and ArborScan went offline, preventing traders from checking transaction details. The timing was particularly bad for crypto markets. Bitcoin dropped to $89,300 during the outage, while Ethereum fell below $3,000. The total cryptocurrency market cap dropped 3% to $3.12 trillion. Man, that's crazy how technology sets off everything.
No, it's not. Because we talk about confidentiality and integrity all the time, but availability is, it's the big one.
Yeah. I had a meme. It was like another one bites the dust, and it was the Reaper. It had AWS, and it had Cloudflare on it.
Another one bites the dust.
So let's see what this part says. Why does outage matters for internet resilience? The Cloudflare incident revealed how fragile modern internet infrastructure really is. Three companies, Cloudflare, Amazon Web Services, and Azure, handle most of the world's web traffic. When any one of them fails, large portions of the internet stop working. This wasn't the first major outage in recent months. Amazon Web Services suffered a similar failure October 2025, affecting Coinbase and Robinhood. These repeated incidents show that the internet infrastructure has become dangerously centralized. Cloudflare operates data centers in 330 cities worldwide and connects directly to 13,000 networks. The company's servers include protection from cyber attacks, content delivery, and domain name resolution. When these systems fail, websites couldn't determine where to send user requests or how to handle incoming traffic. Now let's see what they say. How companies can protect against future outages. You know, I'm providing these and say redundancy. Smart businesses are already taking steps to reduce their dependence on single infrastructure providers. The most effective strategy involves using multiple service providers instead of relying on just one company. Multi-CDN approaches spread website traffic across different networks. If one provider fails, traffic automatically switches to the backup systems. Companies can set up these failover systems to activate within minutes rather than hours. DNS diversification represents another critical protection method. Instead of using one company for a domain name resolution, businesses can split this function across multiple providers. This prevents websites from becoming completely unreachable when one provider experiences problems. Let me see. So I was kind of like, they're just in a nutshell, but showing like the repercussions of that. And I don't know why more companies haven't been using like multi-CDNs and why they're just relying on one.
I think I want to give a shout out to the engineer who pushed that update. I hope he felt like the GOAT.
Which one? The one that broke it or the one that fixed it?
The one that fixed it. The one that fixed it. I know they was probably like, see, the next day, like, that. Just think about saying that in the interview. Yeah, like, I was the one who fixed this update at my last company when X, Y, and Z happened. But I like that they didn't give us any fluff. They were like, yep, we pushed a bad update. This is what happened, and this is what we're doing to fix it. So I always like when people get to it and be honest, because we say this all the time in cyber. It's not if it's going to happen to you. It's when it's going to happen to you. And that is what we are seeing time and time again. Everybody is experiencing something that is causing a disruption in their services. And it's going to continue to be that way if people continue to move to the cloud.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, this is one of these conversations we've been talking about for a while about why they're looking for people to be technical.
I just told someone the other day, I'm like, staying on the technical side does give you, if you can have a business conversation to talk about strategy and how to achieve goals and objectives and KPIs and all of that great stuff, and you're technical, you a bad mamma jamma or sir majamma.
But nah, man, shout out to Cloudflare. They got on it. I mean, it sucks for the people.
That's
I wonder how much money people lost.
But that's how you handle business, the way they went about it. That's how you do it.
For sure. What you have on the docket?
Let's talk about reasonable doubt.
Okay.
Oh, my God. I've not been okay. I'm still not okay. I cannot believe that they killed him. Ozzy did not deserve to go. I wanted him to stay on and be her honorary son. I was in shambles. Like,
it might have been a money thing, though.
I was hysterically crying. I could not believe that it happened so fast. It happened so fast. But he acted his star off. He ate it down for sure. I'm very proud of him, and I hope he wins some awards for his performance on the show, because I think he really. At first, I told you that I was getting a little irritated with his storyline. I'm like, okay, I'm over it. I don't want to keep hearing about it, but it just kept getting better episode after episode.
Yeah, we be calling Josh Ozzy. Is that how Ozzy Harry is? You miss him calling him that. Or, you know, his real name you found out was Orsel. So.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. And I'm happy they got renewed for season 4. The way that it ended was crazy.
You know, the whole time.
Jax, you better be there.
But you know, the whole time, we were thinking that Monica was Louie from Snowfall. And it's old girl from
no, it's
P-Valley.
That's her. That's the same person.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Mercedes and Louis ain't the same person.
Yes, they are.
No way.
I'm finna argue with you about it. Let me see.
No, because they went.
Yes, that is the same person.
It's not the same person.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
And Snowfall.
Just do Louis Snowfall.
Oh, okay. Brandy is in P-Valley and Snowfall. What was her name?
Aunt Louie is played by Angela Lewis.
They do look alike. Ah, they do look alike. So it was Brandy, though, right?
Yeah, it was the one that played what?
In P-Valley.
Yeah.
But she's good, though. She anytime she come on the screen, people get happy.
Well, she didn't really have a lot of lines, though, to be honest.
It don't matter. She came with that.
But she was smaller, too. Wasn't she, like, thicker in P-Valley? I didn't really watch the show. That wasn't a show for me, guys. Just letting you know.
P-Valley, she was. I don't know. They didn't really show her body like that in.
They showed it a little bit when she was in.
Not like
Ozzy.
They did in P-Valley.
Yeah, of course not. I mean, they could have. It was Hulu. I mean, all the stuff they'd be having Jackson Lewis be doing.
Okay. She love her man, her man, her man.
Yeah, Lewis was, I don't know, he was too nice.
I wanted there to be some, I'm messy. I wanted there to be some more drama between him and the BM.
I didn't. You know why I didn't?
Just a little bit.
You know why I didn't?
Why?
Because every show, they never let the couple have a, like, have their vow. Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's what my, one of my
gripes. No, Bel Air did.
I think
new
kinda.
Season drops
at,
next week.
At first, they weren't going to do it.
They were cut. That whole.
Because my whole issue with Greenleaf was that. Like, they didn't let them work it out. You didn't see it with Tasha and Ghost. I feel like they could have.
But that's like real life, though. Most times, people don't be working it out.
But the thing is, it could have.
Okay.
It very well could have, but they would make, like, it's just when the writing started getting kind of stupid when he's like, bro, come on now.
I think it was still a good play to bring her back up and there to still be a conflict, but I'm not mad that they're still together. But I did want it to get a little bit more spicier between them.
I mean, it got a little spicy. I mean, he don't know that Corey Cash was at the house.
She did. She told him.
She told him that.
She told him that he stayed the night.
Oh.
She did.
I guess he had no choice but to eat it.
That's why when he met them, the way they interact is hilarious. Yes.
I don't blame him.
You ain't finna come over here, sir. Yeah. But 10 out of 10. Okay. Your turn.
I'm trying to see. It's like so many different interesting things that I saw that I want to talk about. I've seen a lot of people up in arms about education, like loan reform, where they're trying to say certain...
Loan.
Like some of the loan reform... where they're trying to say certain degrees aren't professional.
Please.
Let's see what this is. So I'll read this one. It's like five takeaways from the Department of Education's student loan rulemaking. Let's see. On November 6th, a day earlier than expected, the Department of Education concluded the Reimagining and Improving Student Education Committee. And so here are the five, like four bullet points that at a high level that's talking about. The rollout of new loan limits for graduates and professional students, those attending less than full-time and parent borrowers, the ability of institutions to limit loans for students and parent I'm getting so tongue-tied today, students and parent borrowers in specific programs of study, the integration of new repayment plans into and the elimination of some existing plan and types of deferment from the student loan environment, and modifications to the structure of forbearances and loan rehabilitation provisions from those working to exit default. Now, graduates and professional students will face new loan limits next year. What happens next is still unclear. Perhaps the biggest ticket item on the agenda, at least for institutions around the table, was codifying the definition of a graduate versus a professional degree. Starting on July 1st, 2026, students attending graduate programs will have annual loan limits of $20,500 and aggregate loan limits of $100,000, while those enrolled in programs that award a professional degree will have limits of $50,000 and $200,000. The previous Graduate Plus Loan Program, which allowed borrowing up to a student's cost of attendance, will no longer be available for new borrowers. Interesting. What you think about that?
I think that don't think about them loans. Go to school. Think about them later. Because I feel like you can make your life better, but if you're worried about loans, you might not do it.
Yeah, but I think even for them to want to go to school, they might not be able to go because of the loan limit, because of their choice is not considered professional, and that's actually
it's limited.
You know what? I like to do this.
It's disappointing. I will say that. Because it discourages people from doing things that people need to do. Everybody can't do the same thing or work in the same fields. We need people across all these different industries and sectors for the world to be successful and to be able to thrive and go around.
Right. So by the professional definition's admission, the committee is actually playing itself. So it has three different definitions. Professional, engaged in a specific activity as one's made paid occupation rather than a pastime, a professional boxer. worthy of or appropriate to a professional person, competent, skillful, or assured, relating to or belonging to a profession. And so let's see what they define as, like, professional degrees. What is ABBA? OBBBA took the unusual step of defining a professional degree using an existing regulation as it was in effect on the date the bill was enacted, July 4th, 2025. In that regulation, a professional degree includes but is not limited to pharmacy, dentistry, veterinary medicine, chiropractic, law, medicine, optometry, osteopathic medicine. There we go. Podiatry and theology. How theology going
to
be?
I was just about to say this. Let them have it.
The definition posed a challenge for the rulemaking committee. If professional degrees were not limited to those 10 fields, which others would it include? After initial proposing its own definitions that both limited professional degrees to 10 fields listed above and include a one-year interim period, that would include a greater array of programs, as well as more expansive proposal from some of the negotiators. The department ultimately drafted a multi-part rubric to determine who is eligible for higher loan limits. And the department's final language, a professional degree, includes the 10 fields listed above and clinical psychology, or and includes any other program that is the same 4-digit classification of instructional programs, CIP code, a structure for coding and reporting fields of study and programs in the higher education space, and those 11 fields primarily broadening to psychology programs that qualify, and is at the doctorate level, requiring 6 years of higher education, including at least 2 at the post-baccalaureate level, and requires professional licensure. So, this is like a lot of different stuff. I don't even know what the 4-digit CIP code is.
I don't understand why we put in restrictions on education. What is going on?
So, I will play devil's advocate.
Is this because they don't... Is it because people are in school too long to get a degree? And, you know, you get what I'm saying?
Some people have no intentions of graduating.
That's what I'm saying.
And so they are just getting money to get it.
And getting the max amount. So, I mean, I'm with you. We know people in real life who done did it. They pretend like they're going to go to school. They get that check and they don't show up. That's why they make it so difficult for people at community colleges. That's why you don't get your check until... dang near halfway through the semester because people are out here playing.
Oh, yeah. That refund check.
Yeah.
Not only that, I mean, the real root of the issue is not the loans. It's how much the institutions are charging for the education. Degree. There are no parameters on, hey, if you were a state university, you can't charge excess over this. Because that's how it was. Like, everybody always says this all the time. If an 18-year-old want to start a business and they want a $50,000 loan, the bank will tell them no. If an 18-year-old wanted to go to school and it costs $50,000, they would give it to them.
Yep.
That's like
they will actually give them $60,000.
Yeah, that's a big problem. Yeah. I think that's where it is. So a lot of stuff just snowballed. Like for me, I didn't plan to have the loans that I have, but I always knew in the end that I would be able to pay them off eventually, but on my time. I think my biggest issue always has been with how much they want you to pay back for the loans. I'm like,
the thing is,
nobody should be paying interest on loans.
I agree with you. Now you got me thinking that I pay my loan payment this month. Yeah.
Like, nobody should be paying interest on loans. If anything, just pay the straight-up loan. Like, why are you wanting to make...
And then you'll pay for 5 years, and just that'll be straight interest, especially if you deferred your loans.
Facts. No, I think, like see, it's crazy. And then this other thing, too, is, like, why you just got to have your career strategy. After undergrad, I only owe, like, 10 Gs.
And that's how I was, too. I actually owed less than that because I had a lot of scholarships.
And I lost stuff. Tops. I would have probably only owed like 4 or 5.
I think I owed less than 5.
But then grad school, you know, increased that.
Oh, let's not talk about it.
But I mean, that's...
But that. It is what it is, you know?
But I was actually using it to go to school.
Same. And I was really close with... I think that's important, too, for you to get close with your... Because when you go to grad school, you typically... have, like, undergrad, you can talk to anyone in financial aid, but typically when you go to grad school, you have someone assigned to you, maybe based on your last name or your degree. But I always was really cool with my financial aid rep in grad school because I used to be like, I only want to take out exactly what I need to cover this books or whatever it may be, like, she knew. She was never trying to give me more than, because if you don't know, your semester only costs $20,000, but they approved you for $50,000, right?
I would do
if
that,
you,
too.
If you don't know, you don't know.
Whatever I need. I know.
Now, it's different, though, if you going to use it to pay some bills.
Yeah, because I'm like, life happens. Like,
no,
for
it
me,
do. It do.
I had every intention. I was at work. I had made there a year. Didn't have no type of cap on paying school back. So I was like, cool. I'll have them pay the rest of this, so I won't owe much. But I got laid off. So I ended up getting, like, having to do school, but having, like, a refund check during the time where I actually needed it because I didn't have no money coming in. So I understand, like, life happens, but also the people that's kind of gaming the system and you don't have no intention of doing it, you're messing up for everybody else.
But I feel like there should be some consequence for that. Because there's not really, right? There's not enough of a consequence for people to stop doing it, right?
Yeah, because all you got to do is just
like if you did it at one school, you shouldn't be able to go do it at another school.
All you got to do is be in school and you don't have to pay nothing back.
That part.
Let's see. A phase-in period for new loan limits helps borrowers, but does not apply across the board. In addition to new loan limits for those at the graduate level, as noted above, OBA also sets new loan limits for parents borrowing on the behalf of dependent undergraduate students. Previously limited only to the cost of attendance at the school, but now capped at $20,000 annually and $65,000 in the aggregate per student. The new law also requires the proration of loan limits for students at the undergraduate and graduate levels attending less than full time, and it allows institutions to limit loans for specific programs of study.
I don't like that.
I think that's doable. I think that's decent. 20 G's a year if you got to do like a parent plus loan.
But what if you want to go to a school that costs more than that? That's what I'm saying. Everybody don't want to go to.
So this is why I would love to like have academic stuff, the financial aid people, the people that have the numbers or at the school for admissions, because certain schools that cost more.
I was just talking to somebody. The semester was $60,000. I don't remember what
SMU?
No, I don't think it was. It wasn't here, but it was. You know, it was one of the top joints.
But I guess you got in some of those situations. Are you the top of the top that would be at that school? If not, why not go to a school where you'd be the top of the top and you get more financial resources versus? I know you want to go to this school. Like, I get it. There's people that want to go to the Ivy Leagues and all these other schools. I get it. But I think most people, that's already competitive. Those competitive people probably getting good amount of scholarships. I think they're probably spending money more so on like room and board.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I would love to, if you're listening to this and you went to like the Stanfords or the Yales or the Princetons and you didn't have a full ride or something and you want to talk to us, definitely hit us up because I always wanted to see how that was for somebody when they went to school and how much it cost them. Of course.
Do you feel like it's, most importantly, do you feel like it's worth it? It was worth it.
For those type of schools, yes.
Well, I mean by saying wherever you are today in your life or your career. Like, yeah,
I wouldn't
did
change
it work
it.
Out for you?
Yeah, I wouldn't change it. Yeah. I wouldn't change it. I mean, that's like anything in your life. Like, you try to say, like,
I wouldn't change it either.
You want to change something you might have did bad or wrong, but it's like, at the end of the day, whatever happened got you to
where
you're
at. Exactly. Exactly.
Let me see. I'm trying to see, like, because it's like, these are like some long things. I know big ones, people were like up in arms about the student loan forgiveness. Let me see what else is on here. I don't know. I'm not going to read all of it, but I do know those are differences. I know they are working on like, hey, how much of your disposable income can actually go to paying a loan?
Just because it's disposable to y'all don't mean it's disposable to me, first of all.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because what? Huh? Hold on now. You ain't finna get all of that now. Hold on. It's a joke. It's a joke how much money they want back from you. They want you to pay all of your money for the loans and have not enough money to cover your bills.
Right.
And your day-to-day expenses.
You got to hit
that's
it
why
this
most,
right here.
That's why most people are on some sort of a payment
plan.
A payment plan that's going to be for the next 20 years. Otherwise, they want all your money.
Look, you got to hit them with this right here.
Stop. Take lives. What do you mean by that?
But nah, you got to hit my, what do you mean by that? Man, I'm not finna pay y'all that. Hey, look, you know how the people like.
I could not believe how much money they wanted when it was time for me to start paying back on my student loans. I was floored. Like, called my grandparents, like, is this normal or what?
I was just like, hey, y'all can come get the degree back.
For real. No, for real.
Take it. Shit. I know how to do the job now. Come get it back. Oh, man. I can't see what else you got written over there.
I guess I will talk a little bit about DoorDash.
Okay.
So, if you are a Dash passer like myself, meaning you subscribe monthly, DoorDash was recently hit with a social engineering attack, which means someone on the inside essentially was finessed. So a worker fell for a phishing attempt. The attackers got into internal systems and they were able to pull customer contact info. So names, emails, phone numbers, physical addresses. So their customers, their Dashers, and the merchants were all affected. And of course, they did not disclose how many people were hit. Now, why this matters is because they said that no sensitive information was accessed. And
let's add a yet on that.
But I think sensitive information was.
Mm-hmm.
I just said what it was. Names, emails, phone numbers, physical addresses. That is sensitive information. So I don't really, know. You got a phone number and an address, that's a good combination. That's gold if you're a scammer, if you are trying to stalk or harass or whatever it may be to that person. Anything tied to your identity is sensitive. So I don't understand why companies are still hiding behind the definitions instead of acknowledging what the risk is itself. And obviously this is not their first time. In 2019, they were breached and lost data on about 5 million users, and it took them a long time to discover or notice when that did occur. So I guess this one is maybe not necessarily a huge shocker, but whenever companies do have, incidents of this extent multiple years apart, it's a culture thing, not really a coincidence, right?
Yes, is that it's there have really been no advance. It's like
I want to know what they're doing for like their end user training.
No, that's what I'm saying. This segment should be security awareness sucks. It's most places use the same old thing
every year. Like, they don't update it. There's no if you for example. 5 years ago, we weren't worried about QR codes. If you don't have in your security training, and that's something that's coming into your tenant, your exchange, whatever you're using, if you're not teaching your users not to pick up that phone and just scan everything that they see, if your users don't know how to report things as phishing, if reporting things as phishing requires them to forward the email to the help desk, we're even past that. So you'd be surprised at how many companies are not doing it because they don't have the time. But end users are the weakest link in the company.
Let's go into different things that they don't even think about. How about telling the people at your company, only use your work phone for work. Do not try to cancel your plan and try to use your work phone for your personal.
That is a lot. That's a lot.
I ain't gonna lie. It's kind of smart. Like, you stay at a company 15 years, I ain't got no cell phone bill. No. Call me right here.
These companies have a lot of things that they can do with these EDRs.
They can, but in all honesty, like, unless you are, like, working, like, in the government or, like, you handle a lot of sensitive information, they're not worried about it. They just want to – they have a profile on it just in case, like, if your phone gets stolen, they wipe it and all the other stuff. But to be honest, I mean, it's a good idea, but it's bad because – if you do get something happen or you download something on your phone that the profile didn't stop and they're able to SIM swap you or get information off of your phone and you're using the same passwords for your work stuff, that's how it can start leading to some things that happen over into an actual enterprise environment, which is a different use case that people have to think about.
Yeah. And also, a lot of companies have these solutions and they're not even using – they don't even know the breadth of different features they can turn on to augment, audit, alert on what is happening, right?
Yeah.
You can actually see the prompts that your users are putting into AI tools if you want.
Yeah. And let's talk about this too. When I go back to people using their work phone for their personal. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say if this is a sloppy person, because this is how a lot of these people got compromised back in the day. I think it was on Uber, somebody else from LinkedIn. You let everybody know what you do on LinkedIn. Now they say, okay, cool. They are a security analyst at Airbnb.
Social engineering.
Let's go see who's a security manager at Airbnb. Oh, cool. Is this person? I found they number. Hey, so-and-so, this is blah, blah, blah. We got a meeting at whatever time. Click this link so you can join the Zoom. Now, a lot of people are not paying attention. They didn't click the link, and now they didn't got harvested.
Can we talk about the links? Y'all got to be careful. You got to be careful. You have to be careful. You don't want to be the person that is the cause of falling for ransomware, a phishing attack, or worse, whatever. You be careful. When in doubt, report it out. I report it. I don't care what report. It'll come back to me if it's not. I would rather be cautious than in a predicament to be the cause of something destructive happening to the company.
Nah, that's facts. Hang on a second. I begin paranoid. For real, man. And what I was going to say? Oh, not only that, when you're talking about reporting it out, the phishing simulations, they do stuff that's funny. They might make, I seen one time, they was like, hey, click here if you don't want to change your password no more.
And you gonna click there.
What's the one we read where it was like we read the tweet where the dude was like, the person failed the phishing simulation because they said click on here for like to talk about your salary or some crap like that.
Yes, we just talked about that too. I don't remember.
Yeah, that was hilarious to me. Speaking of that, I thought about going into a TikTok that I have on there, and it's gonna tie into a LinkedIn post that I want to talk about. Where is it? This job crash out from this woman. Let me click on her thing for TikTok.
So I had to come on here and crash out for a second. I already crashed out of my family group chat, and they encouraged me that I should post this on TikTok because it's a very valid crash out. But I am literally on lunch right now from my job that I've been at for 3 years. I check my email and I get yet another denial letter from a job that I was 100% sure that I got. When I tell y'all I don't understand what it is, I don't know what it is. I've applied to over 500 jobs within this last year in 2025. Out of those 500 jobs, I might have gotten 10 interviews. I went back to school. I got a master's degree. I have all this experience that I put on my resume that I've actually done, and I still cannot land a new job when I don't know what it is. I understand the job market is terrible and all these different things that are going on, but like, come on now. So I feel like I've applied myself like so much within this last year just to try to get a better position for myself. I cannot get anything. I don't know what to do no more. I'm trying so hard to keep the faith. I'm trying so hard. I'm trying to stay positive. I'm trying to say, oh, well, maybe this wasn't the job for me. This was the, but come on now. Every job, not the job for me. Out of 500 jobs that I've applied for, every single one was not the one for me. I said all that to say this. Because I'm desperate at this point. If y'all can give me any type of insight, any type of resume assistance, if you know a recruiter, currently work as an executive administrative assistant, but I'm trying to pivot over into IT. That is what I have my master's degree in. I went back to school, got my master's degree in information communication technology. I have hopes to become a project manager or a product manager one day. I need help. If you have anyone or know anyone or can give any type of insight to help me get a better position, I would greatly appreciate it. I know so many people on TikTok are going through this same exact thing right now. Feel the same way. Feel like they're crashing out. Feel like they can't get anything. I know y'all feel this same exact way as me. So I don't know what to do besides phone a friend. And right now I'm phoning the world because I need help. Desperately. So I had to come on here and crash.
That was my first time actually watching it. You know what's funny? If you didn't move, the lights probably would have stayed off.
That is what a lot of people are going through right now. Like, it's we talk about this every week. We say the same things, and it's like beating a dead horse, and everybody's doing something different and at a different phase of that experience. But it's not just you. I don't know what else to say anymore besides that, is that it's not just you.
Yeah, it's a couple of things I would want to say. First of all, hopefully, like, I'm going to cut this part of the video up and, like, put her video in it, and I'm going to try to send her a message. Because we have people who have been project managers and program managers. And I forgot who else who's been on the show. And I can send you those episodes. Secondly, just applying when you're trying to pivot is not going to be the best deal for you because you don't have the experience that most other people have that you're going against. And also there comes the part of the resume. It is a lot of other things I can ask her. Yeah, you had 10 interviews. So out of them 10, how well do you think you did? Because I've listened to people's interviews where they thought they did well. When I listened to them, they didn't do well. Mm-hmm. So
it's all, yep. And I also think, just like you said, just strictly applying, it's not going to be the best route. You need to get to know somebody who knows somebody. Whether that's a recruiter, a hiring manager, a mentor, whoever it may be, somebody that can hopefully mention your name in rooms that you don't have maybe access to yet.
No, that's facts. And so that ties into the, let me see where it is. I got to find it on here. Well, I have the invisible versus the visible job market. Mm-hmm. So this guy's a cybersecurity recruiter. He said, 73% of cybersecurity jobs, I feel, never get posted.
I agree.
Here's how to access the hidden market. Most people think job hunting works like this. Search Indeed, LinkedIn, apply to postings, wait for callback. That's the visible market. But the best roles, they're filled before you ever see them. How the hidden market actually works. Week one, company needs a security engineer. Week two, CISO asks their team, know anyone good? Week three, someone refers a former colleague. Week four, candidate interviews and gets offer. Week five, job gets posted for compliance HR. Week six, 200 people apply to an already filled role. You were competing for a job that was decided 4 weeks ago.
That part. We talk about that all the time. We always talk about that. Legally, they have to post the role. Regardless of who they decide they're going to give it to, they have a legal requirement or obligation most times to post the role, to be fair, but they still could have someone out. And that's just the law of the land.
Facts. And so for me, I typically ask, like, for example, a lot of times I apply to someone. Well, before I applied to roles at CrowdStrike, I got my old manager as a director there. And I'm not cool with one of the recruiters there, but I got the information. So anytime I apply for something for that specific division of CrowdStrike or I see a job, I'm like, yo, how far along are y'all in this process before I even waste my time? And mm-hmm. he'll be like, we probably have an offer out pretty soon to somebody. And I'm like, appreciate it. Why do I do that? Because I don't want to waste my time. And that's what tends to happen a lot of times in these things. Somebody's already been referred. I know it's plenty of times I referred a former colleague. Like, if they said, hey, we got like two more openings on the team. You know anybody? Yeah, I work with this guy over here. And they like him and he get hired. That's literally how it works.
But also, referrals don't always be working.
Referrals don't be working.
And they most times, they don't really help.
Well, who refers you is what matters.
Okay. Clock that part. If the hiring manager refers you, or the recruiter, or someone that knows one of them.
Or a director.
Or somebody that is, like you said, higher up. But just someone at the company, it really isn't helping people, get the job.
You should. That's why I say I don't really look to get a, like, if you work in accounting, I don't really think your referral to a security role at Meta is as best as a person that's a security engineer that's referring me for a security role that's mm-hmm. probably interacting with the team.
Exactly. You might, the person on the security team, even if they're not on the team, they might know somebody that's connected. Yeah.
And if they like what I say and I'm saying, hey, man, like, that's why I always try to talk to them, hey, what y'all looking for? Mm-hmm. I've did this, this, and this. And so that's why I do teach the proactive thing. But he did give some ways to access it.
I like that.
So he said, method one, the warm intro. Code apply through job portal. Warm, hey, connection, I saw companies building a SOC. Know who's leading that, and then ask for an intro. Hiring managers would rather interview a referral than a screen 300 strangers. And this is facts. That's why I typically go to the source.
I actually like that. I like the example that he gave.
But some people don't be answering, though.
And that's okay. You still reached out. All you can do.
And I'm going to say, it hurts because it'd be a job you really want, but don't be a bugaboo. Like, just kind of. They don't respond. You could probably follow up again.
I was going to say maybe one more follow up and then keep it pushing.
Yeah. Like, it was like, I know you see my, I know you connected with me, so why didn't you, like, you ain't got more followers than me. How you didn't see my
And
my
the message? Only reason I'm going to say follow up, too, is because people are so busy.
Yeah.
Like.
But I think my case is rather different. I got more followers than most people. So yeah. I know how my inbox is. So I'm like, your stuff ain't as busy as mine.
Clock that part, too.
So. But I ain't going to crash out on somebody I don't know. Like, hey, I know you seen this
I
message,
I know you
dog.
Seen this message.
Like, when back in the day when people actually left voicemails on your phone.
Yeah.
Method two, the LinkedIn signal. When you see a company announce new funding, new CISO hire, major client win, compliance certification, they're about to hire security people. Comment on the post, DM the CISO, ask about their security roadmap. Method three, the recruiter relationship. Don't just apply when you need a job. Build a relationship with 3 to 5 recruiters now. Update them quarterly. Share when you learn new skills. Ask about market trends. When the perfect role appears, they call you first. Method four, the problem solver approach. Most effective but requires research. Identify 10 companies you want to work for. Follow their security team on LinkedIn. When they post about a challenge, engage thoughtfully. Eventually, I've been thinking about their problem. Mind if I send you my thoughts? You're building a relationship, not sending applications.
Facts. I actually love the last one the most. I like that one a lot.
Yeah. He says, your 30-day action plan. Week one, identify the 10 target companies. Follow their security leaders. Week two, engage on 3 to 5 posts per week. Add value. Don't pitch yourself. Week three, connect with 3 recruiters in your space. Have actual conversations, not just, are you hiring? Week four, ask your network, who's hiring security people right now? Request warm intros. The truth, the visible job market is overcrowded. The hidden market is where the best opportunities are. Stop applying harder, start networking smarter. Have you ever gotten a job that was never posted? How did it happen?
What was the second one?
Which one?
That you, at the bottom.
The hidden market is where the best opportunities are?
No, you was like, rule three, rule.
Engage in 3 to 5 posts per week.
And then you said don't.
Oh, don't pitch yourself.
Engage first before you start to send people pitches about yourself. Just in, because people will peep. Okay. Before you take it directly to the inbox and try to, because people can tell.
Yeah, and like what
LinkedIn
I do too.
Will be like just following you for 2 days, and now you already pitching yourself. Like, chill.
And what I do, too, is, hey, if a recruiter from, like, an agency or something reached out to me, and maybe I'm not the best fit for the role, but I know somebody, I try to help them by getting them a candidate that's qualified.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they might spend a block on me and say, hey, I got something for you.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great. And it's all about relationships. I am actually, while we're talking about this, to my current clients and students, one of the next things you guys should be getting access to when I finally sit down and do it, I'm going to make a spreadsheet of all the recruiters I probably interacted with over the last 4 to 5 years. And hopefully if they're still at the same companies, and it's going to be a spreadsheet with their email. That way when you apply to certain roles, you could just send them an email to where they get it. Because they prefer an email versus LinkedIn. A lot of times they don't see the LinkedIn messages.
And they probably have way too many. Yeah.
Right. And then you may even throw a dad joke or something in there to get, like, you know, hey. But no, that was good. I think that's actual
I'm
advice.
I'm screaming. A dad joke.
Yeah, that's Jermaine said something about that. There's like something like you stick out. Dang it. Every week, one of my, I think it's like Wednesday or something like that, one of my teammates, he tells us like 2 or 3 dad jokes on our handoff.
Period.
And they be having some loaded ones. They're pretty funny sometimes.
All right. North Korea. Remote IT worker fraud ring. Why does it matter? So 5 people in the U.S. just pleaded guilty to helping North Korea workers get remote IT jobs at American companies. According to the Department of Justice, they used their own identities or stolen false identities of U.S. citizens. They let North Korean workers remote into laptops physically sitting in their homes. They helped them pass vetting, including drug tests. They hosted company-issued equipment to make it look like the workers lived in the U.S. And so the impact was 136 U.S. companies were hit. 2.2 million funneled back to North Korea's, what's the word? Regimen? Say it.
Regimen?
There we go. Roles included developer and IT support roles that had access, obviously, to sensitive systems, per some of the reports that I took a look at. The Department of Justice and security researchers have been saying this for years. North Korea uses remote IT job fraud to fund its nuclear weapons program. It is internationally sanctioned, so this is one of their main ways to earn money. They've infiltrated, obviously, hundreds of Western companies in the last few years. They also run identity theft rings and crypto hacks as revenue streams. And so a lot of those statements are kind of coming from the Department of Justice, like their public statements that they've put out and some of the advisories that we see. So who pleaded guilty? We have Audris, I don't know his last name, for wire fraud conspiracy. Jason for wire fraud conspiracy. Alexander is an active duty U.S. Army during the scheme. And then Eric placed certified remote workers using fake identities. So Travis has to pay $50,000. Prince has to pay $89,000. Salazar both have to pay about $3,000 to $4,000 each for the identities, basically, that they stole. But why does this matter if you consider yourself to be a regular person, I guess, would kind of be the bigger issue. Identity theft is still a billion-dollar industry, and so seeing those stolen identities, it could have been one of yours. If you don't have, or if you ain't monitoring your credit, if you're not getting alerted, you probably won't find out until it's too late, and maybe you're trying to go get a car or a house and you can't. Remote work widened the attack surface. Obviously, it's easier for you to be able to hide behind a laptop versus physically going into the office. Companies are not prepared to verify who's actually logging into their devices. That might be why it may be important for companies to start thinking about using biometrics to be able to access company equipment. It's obviously expensive. It's costly. There's a lot that goes into that, but that might be a way to help. And then also national security issues. So if you hire the wrong workers, right, that can literally fund some type of foreign weapon program situation. Like I said, they took the drug test. They remoted into laptops using inside of U.S. homes, used faked or stolen identities, paid facilitators to pretend to be them. And then companies were not able to really detect these unless they were using tools like AnyDesk or TeamViewer. So that is that. Remote work really did open up the world for some things that maybe we weren't. I mean, no one can predict when we went remote that this was going to be something that we have to worry about.
Some people probably did. I would say that because we talked about this a couple of times, like we followed up on all these things.
Yeah.
This is why, like in a blue team sense, a lot of companies started monitoring for, hey, if we see anybody using a KVM, let's look into it because we want to make sure that they're actually American and not from North Korea.
What is a KVM?
A KVM is a machine, that's a tool that would...
Like a software or something?
It's like, yeah, it's a... before I butcher it, because I know how to explain it in layman's terms, a KVM thing is like you can plug your computer into it and you can use like another computer to access like one of your other computers. But to get the technical definition of it, so, and it actually did it wrong. Let me see. So... KVM is an acronym that refers to two different technologies, keyboard, video, mouse, switch. This is a hardware device or kernel-based virtual machine, which is a virtualization technology for Linux. A KVM switch lets you control multiple computers with a single keyboard, monitor, and mouse, while KVM as a virtualization technique turns a Linux computer into a platform running virtual machines. So that's how a lot of people are able to access those machines. Because they'll just put a KVM switch on it, and then they can just access it from wherever they want to. And that's why companies are monitoring for that to stop it. Two, there are companies now, like, I feel like for every problem, that's where new companies are birthed. If we real quick go back to the issue with Cloudflare, or while there probably be other companies like Cloudflare who already exist that maybe start getting more business so companies can be a little bit more redundant and have availability. There are companies that are investing into this technology to determine if you are who you say you are in interviews.
I'm not mad.
Because you have people.
Especially if we think about from like a federal perspective, like I'm not mad at it. I would rather keep us safe over here and our data and all of these things that we're working on. I would rather keep that safe.
Yeah, then not. Let me see what the name of the company is, because they were showcasing a person interviewing. It was like, yeah, we can, we can go against like this type of stuff because we know what to look for. And there was like using like tools that match people's voice with what they say and everything else. So let's see. Oh, well, here it is. It's John Sasser. Someone reading this likely has a fake employee in the organization right now. Over the past weeks, I walked through the fake candidate spectrum from fraud rings running interview mills to organized crime planning ransomware operators to state-sponsored actors targeting your IP. Today, we're officially launching InterviewSafe. We're the security layer your hiring process is missing. Identity verification and real-time fraud detection embedded directly into video interviews, not after the background check. Not on day one, during the interview itself, because by the time traditional screening catches a fake candidate, they've already wasted 40 hours of your team's time. Or worse, they're already inside. InterviewSafe authenticates candidates using biometric identity verification, real-time fraud detection, network analysis and location intelligence, fraud risk scoring using OSINT-enriched metadata. So interesting. And this is...
intelligence databases in real time. Within seconds, we generate a safe score. High-risk candidates get flagged before they waste your time or access sensitive information. In this case, facial recognition patterns detected the mismatch, network activity and device signals indicated suspicious patterns and location, and the individual was found to be on a number of sanction lists. With InterviewSafe, you'll catch synthetic identities, deepfakes, sanctioned individuals, and coordinated fraud rings before they enter your hiring pipeline. InterviewSafe stops insider threats at the point of maximum vulnerability, the interview stage. Don't let your next hire be a national security threat.
I am not mad, but we always have to consider discrimination. In what, obviously that was an advertisement, but right. I have questions.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, also it's like, how are you getting access to this data of IDs and stuff like that, which is why I think I had the digital ID thing on here. But it'll be interesting. Like, if you're not a person that's on all that stuff, were you good? And also, when you bought a biometric stuff, right, that machine over there has, well, even my MacBook has a fingerprint thing. Granted, the MacBook.
Bring those back. Bring fingerprints back.
The MacBook knows it's me. But how does my company know it's me whose fingerprint is on there?
Unless you registered in office. So, you know what I mean? Like, in person.
Well, it's hard unless they're going to get the data. So, like, a lot of these companies, if you get a certain type of job in a certain industry, you got to go do fingerprints.
Yeah.
I don't know that they'll connect it on the back end.
I was just going to say they don't have those fingerprints because mm-hmm. it's not going to them.
Exactly.
I'm not mad at that. Yeah. I'm not mad at that at all, especially knowing, like, I'm so mad I just closed that down.
I've heard of the horror stories. I'm literally, my old manager was like, hey, we have to fire somebody. The person we interviewed, that wasn't them.
But just even think about the person that you working with directly, your right-hand man at work, ain't really them.
Yeah, for sure. And so it's just a lot. It's just a lot. But it's pretty fun. I say, hey, that's one of those use cases you bring up for insider threat. Like, that's why I know I was in a process not too long ago, and immediately they said, all right, cool, we need to get on a video interview. And they just wanted to verify if I was the same person that they saw on my LinkedIn and also where else they saw me at.
Yeah.
And it was like, he was telling me, he's like, we run into so many fake candidates. Like, this is how we weed out a lot of people.
Is video?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, they got tools on their back end trying to match your voice and everything else.
The ad there, who finna do an interview with a mask on?
Some people might.
That's suspicious.
It depends on where they at, though.
It's suspicious based on what we know that goes on in the industry. Forget whatever reasons why you got it on. It doesn't matter. That is irrelevant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's irrelevant. But it is suspicious.
No, I agree. I think you next.
The FCC. All right. So the FCC has reversed telecom security rules after Chinese hacks. So the FCC has voted 2-1 to reverse a Biden-era security rule that required telecom companies to harden their systems that are used for lawful surveillance. What does that mean? Basically, the systems that the FBI uses when they are wiretapping someone. Now, why does this matter? Because the systems were literally hacked by Chinese espionage group Salt Typhoon. We've talked about them time and time again. This happened last year. They didn't just get into random systems. They access the wiretap portals. Let's just pause right there for a minute. The systems that control who the government is listening to. So in this example, some people were JD, Kamala, so on. Now, why did the FCC roll it back? The leadership under Brendan Carr said the old FCC overstepped their authority. Their security requirements were too broad and burdensome. They prefer voluntary cooperation from telecoms instead of mandates, and telecoms are already doing enough. Democratic Commissioner Anna Gomez was the only no vote. Shout out to Anna. And she snapped. Her message was basically voluntary security is not real security. Clock it, because it's not. Now, why is this a big deal? Because the systems that were hacked are exactly the ones that host the wiretap requests, store phone metadata, store geolocation data, let the FBI listen to calls in real time, obviously with a warrant. Now, if you hack that system, essentially you can spy on whoever they're spying on, right? So foreign intelligence agencies love these systems because it gives them that backdoor into communications that are going on. Now, we do have multiple senators that basically were saying, why are we loosening security when a whole nation state just exploited these same systems? They're essentially saying, like, this is backwards. Now, their biggest concerns is that voluntary cooperation has no teeth. Agreed with that. There's no enforcement. Telecoms can choose the cheapest option, which they will, which usually means the weakest security. And this decision makes the U.S. in turn less secure. None of the improvements that the FCC bragged about would have stopped the SALT Typhoon hacks. In other words, they're basically saying we're pretending that the threat isn't real just because regulation of the threat is inconvenient. And inconvenience is always going to be the thing. People are always going to complain. And in a way, you just have to tell them to get over it. For real. It's just a culture thing. So I just kind of feel like that the telecoms want more flexibility, but the regulators obviously want to have that assurance that we're protected or that we're safe. SALT Typhoon compromised dozens of telecom companies across different countries. So it wasn't a baby breach is basically what I'm trying to say.
And it's crazy how much, you know, of our information is buried with telecom and why.
Especially if you don't have that number since elementary, middle, high school, it's college. Like
they make, I don't know. These companies make you jump through hoops through the interview process just to get hit on something easy. And I just don't understand it for the life of me about that. But then go into like the FBI, like, okay, there should be parameters around these things. Like,
I think we have to get over, I think to make a strong security decision, you have to be willing to tell people that you don't care. I don't care if this inconveniences you. I don't care if you don't want to MFA. I don't care if you don't want to pull out your phone to provide that second factor. Because a lot of the times these things are not implemented because people are too worried about the inconvenience that it brings to their user. And when it comes to security, you're going to be inconvenienced, period.
And if they can't figure out that simple stuff, then it's about time for them to get a new job.
That part. If you don't want an MFA, don't. Don't work here.
Yeah. Come like, you have no choice, and it's simple. But it's got to the point, man, it's crazy. When I really go back 10 years ago, we did not have so many passwords.
No. If I think about 2014, when I was working in a call center and accessing all these different softwares, there was a password for each system.
Now you do passwordless or SSO.
SSO for the win.
But I'm just talking about just regular stuff, right? You got your car insurance, you got your...
You'll use the same password.
But I'm saying, no, not for that. I'm just saying for just in general. Like, a lot of people still don't use password managers. Oh, they got their passwords written down at the house.
I'm going to tell you right now, the best thing that you can do is use one and actually update it when you change the password. I think I struggle with them only because I switch between so many devices. So if I don't update it,
that's why I told you
on my laptop, you did tell me it was an extension.
I told you just use Dashlane. Because anytime you log in and change the password, it automatically does it. Or just like if you need to make one on the phone, it's going to, wherever you got the extension at, you'll be able to log in from whatever.
Yeah. What is it?
Dashlane. Okay. It has what? VPN. It has dark web monitoring. They have a lot of different stuff. But they don't really
work. But it's an extension.
No, it's an app. But if you're using Safari or Chrome or Edge, they have an extension for your
I remember browser. You said something about an extension.
But yeah, they don't really do work with podcasts like that. So I'm not telling y'all to go get it because I ain't getting a cut.
Me neither.
All right. So I was on TechCrunch and I came across an article. And it's about an anime. I've never watched this anime. People might keep me in the comments, but I've never watched Ghost in the Shell. But I know what it is. My cousin had like this big Ghost in the Shell poster at his crib. But the article was, how the classic anime Ghost in the Shell predicted the future of cybersecurity 30 years ago. The year is 2030. An infamous mystery hacker known as Puppet Master is wreaking havoc on the internet, breaking into the so-called cyber brains of several humans, as well as every terminal on the network. As it turns out, the Puppet Master is a creation of Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In other words, the Puppet Master is what we would call today a government-backed hacker or advanced persistent threat. In this case, however, the Phantom Hacker goes rogue and is wanted for stock manipulation, spying, political engineering, terrorism, and violation of cyber brain privacy. I'm going to have to watch this.
No, I just was thinking that.
That is the basic premise of the Japanese anime cult classic Ghost in the Shell, which marked its 30th anniversary this week since its debut was based on the chapters titled Bye Bye Clay and Ghost Coast from the first volume of the eponymous manga released in May 1989. To say that the story of the Puppet Master was ahead of its time may be an understatement. The World Wide Web, essentially what flourished from the internet as we know it today, was invented in 1989, the same year that the first volume of Ghost in the Shell's manga, including the story of the Puppet Master, hit newsstands in Japan. In the manga, when a Puppet Master gets caught, an official from Public Security Section 6, an agency under the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, explains that they had been after the hacker for a long time and they profiled his behavioral tendencies and code tech patterns. As a result, we were finally able to create a special anti-puppeteer attack barrier, the official says in the manga. At the risk of extrapolating too much from a couple of sentences, the reality is that what the official is describing is basically what cybersecurity companies such as antivirus firms do every day to stop malware. Not only do they create so-called signatures based on the malware's code, but also based on its behavior and properties known as heuristics. There are other elements of the plot that turned out to be prescient. This is actually pretty good. This is like, I like stuff like this because it could tie in something that people are interested in and connect them to it.
You can watch it. You can watch it on Adult Swim, Prime, or Netflix.
Clock it. At the beginning of the Puppet Master investigation, Major Motoko Kusanagi, the protagonist and the commander of the Counter-Cyberterrorism Unit, Section 9 hacks into the network of the Sanitation Department to track a garbage truck. These days, government hackers who work for intelligence agencies often break into large networks to spy on a specific individual targets rather than to siphon data out of the hacked network itself. While that happens, one of the garbage men confesses to his colleague that he hacked into his wife's cyber brain because he thinks that she is cheating on him. And you know what's funny? Robots gonna be doing that for real.
Man.
Right after we find out he's been using a computer virus he got from some programmer, this is clear case of tech-enabled domestic abuse or even stalkerware, which TechCrunch has investigated extensively over the last few years. As it turns out, the abusive garbage man had no wife. His memories were all made up. His ghost, essentially his mind or consciousness, was hacked by the Puppet Master with the goal of using him to hack into the government. In some way, that's similar to what some advanced hackers do when they hack into networks. They use to hack their actual target as a way to hide their tracks, adding separation from themselves and final target, social engineering, pretty much. Let's see. Where are we at? John Willander, a cybersecurity veteran who writes hacker-themed fiction books, wrote an exhaustive analysis of the movie that highlighted details referencing real-life scenarios. Willander gave examples like hackers reusing known exploits or malware to make attribution more difficult, investigating malware without alerting the authors, and infecting yourself with it and using computers for industrial espionage. Obviously, the manga and anime take the basic and realistic premise of the Puppet Master as a hacker into more fantastical directions. The hacker, which turns out to be an advanced artificial intelligence, can control humans through their cyber brains and is self-aware to the point that, spoiler alert, it asks for political asylum and ends up proposing to Kusanagi to fuse their ghosts, essentially their minds. To understand how prophetic Ghost in the Shell was, it's crucial to point in its historical context. In 1989 and 95, cybersecurity wasn't even a word yet, although the term cyberspace had been famously coined by sci-fi author William Gibson in his classic book, Neuromancer. Computer security or information security, however, was already a reality and had been for a couple of decades, but it was an extremely niche specialty with computer science. The first computer virus is believed to be the creeper worm, which was unleashed in 1971 on the ARPANET, the government-developed network that became the Internet's forerunner. A handful of other viruses and worms wreak havoc after that. They became ubiquitous once the internet and the World Wide Web became a reality. Man, it's a lot. I'm getting a history lesson right here.
Nah, facts.
Perhaps the very first documented government espionage campaign on the internet was one discovered. My eyes watering bad for no reason. I don't feel like getting my stuff for that.
They read too.
I know. Okay. Perhaps the very first documented government espionage campaign of the internet was the one discovered by Clifford Stoll, an astronomer by training who also manages the computers at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. In 1986, Stoll noticed a 75% accounting error in the network, which eventually led him to discover that a hacker had broken into the lab systems. In the end, the hacker was identified and found to have been feeding information from the lab and U.S. government networks to the Soviet Union's KGB. Stoll immortalized his months-long, scrupulous, and painstaking investigation in the book The Cuckoo's Egg, a first-person account that reads like a very detailed and extensive report by security researchers analyzing the hacking campaign carried out by government hackers. The Cuckoo's Egg has since become classic, but it's probably fair to say it didn't exactly hit the mainstream when it was released. As far as I can tell, Ghost in the Shell creator Masumi Shiro never spoke about the real-life events inspiring the hacking plot points in the manga, but it's clear that he was paying attention to what at the time was a hidden world that was alien to most people on Earth who were still years away from being online, let alone being aware of the existence of hackers. I tried to get there. This. I'm not about my eyes out of water. I got no eye drop. Before the museum, I want to actually read The Cuckoo's Egg. And
What is that?
That's a book. So towards the end of the article, The Cuckoo's Egg is a first-person account that reads like a very detailed and extensive report by security researchers analyzing a hacking campaign carried out by government hackers.
Let's hear it.
So I want to read that book, and I want to watch Ghost in the Shell, and there was another book on here. Because honestly, if you go study the history of how cybersecurity came to be, that's kind of how you figure out where we're going and headed, and it's like already different things that we see. I know for me, it was that. I didn't watch Ghost in the Shell, but I used to watch like Cyborg 009, Question Dragon Ball Z. You got the androids, and right now in Boruto, you have people that are cyborgs. And everything else, Cyborg, Teen Titans. So I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool. And the fact, like, they talked about AI, they talked about social engineering, stalkerware, or as we call it, spyware, where people were putting it on there. Now we got, you know, air tags.
It's so unfortunate that something that was supposed to be a good thing has become awful. Awful.
I mean, I'm just going to say it again. Don't think about the use case. Think about the abuse case.
That part.
So, getting to your museum.
All right. So, say it again, please.
What did he say it was called?
Louvre.
Louvre.
Okay, so let's talk about the Louvre heist because, I mean, it happened a while ago. But the reason why I want to bring it up is because they had a lot of security things go on. So obviously this was very embarrassing to them on a national level. I think the director ended up voluntarily either resigning or they were about to resign. So four men pulled up to the Louvre in broad daylight, climbed a wall, smashed a window, and grabbed, obviously, some historic jewelry. And they were out in under 10 minutes. So mission impossible, sort of. Now, what investigators found when they dug into this a little bit was that the museum only had cameras on 39% of its galleries, which means that 61% of that place had zero surveillance. The world's biggest museum was essentially running on a low budget security. And then the cyber part that got me was that in a 2014 audit, it found that their CCTV server password was literally Louvre. And the software that they use, the name of the software is like Thales, and that was also the password. So just straight lowercase, straight default vibes, basically. Meanwhile, leadership spent over $100 million buying new art pieces and redesigning their gallery, but security upgrades were pushed back until 2032. They said, basically, beauty over safety, and the thieves said, all right, bet. Now, officials tried to save face. Security didn't fail, and then a week later they switched it up, like, okay, yeah, security did fail. No one got fired, but the director, like I said, did try to resign, and they declined, like, no, just stay. We can fix it. But the long story short is that clout over controls will always get you robbed. They didn't get hit, obviously, by some real masterminds. They got hit by people that knew that they basically were not paying attention. Just even watching the video of the thing going up this slow was insane. So hopefully they found a way to reallocate the budget, because 2032 is a long ways away. And there's no point of you putting things that cost millions of dollars in a place that is not secured with top flight security of the world, Craig.
Tragic. That remind me of
That's like, I don't know.
Remember when Danny said, Santa Claus is gossip and Craig ain't do nothing.
I have one more.
Okay, because I'm going to say while we had the intermission, we can talk about, briefly, Wale's album came out last week.
Oh, my God. Turn it up. Turn it up. Turn it up. The whole thing. Turn it up.
And I like it. I think it's just like a good listen through. I don't really. It reminds me. I think it's. I don't know. It take a while for albums to sit. But all the people that kind of came out during the same time have made like a similar album. Big Sean's CD was kind of like that. And Wale's CD kind of reminds me of Big Sean's, where like it's growth. I'm going through these different things. I'm expressing these different things with this bottle, Blanco, Reposado, all those different things. He said a line in there was cool. He said, make sure my circle tight so people don't have weird angles or something like that. It was I liked it. But it's cool, though. It's definitely cool. He's been engaging with the fans on X. And
I'm mad that, because I think, I mean, I'll be on TikTok, but I seen a TikTok that said something about J. Cole and him had hung out recently, and then
It's not recent.
It's old.
Yeah, he was.
But even the fact that he felt like he ain't somebody notable.
He like, always feel like that.
He worried about the wrong people.
Well, you got to think about it though. When a lot of your stuff is tied into units you sold and all these things, like you can.
Yeah.
I trust me. I know how he feels when you putting out really good stuff. But you know, sometimes I think he also got in his way. I know he didn't always have the budgets he probably thought he had. It's a lot of stuff that we don't know about.
Facts.
The fact that he's still here putting out good music.
That
it's a
album
testament.
Is just, I like something that I can listen to straight through. Like, I'll be rewinding. I haven't really skipped a lot of songs. It depends on the vibe, but it's such an easy going album. It's easy to listen to. And he was talking some stuff.
And it's funny because as I was driving, I was listening to it and I said, hey, I just thought about 2010. Because the only thing before, only thing I knew about Wale was Girls.
That's his first album.
Pretty Girl. I think so. That
and More
Nike
About
Boots.
Nothing?
No.
Before that?
I forgot what his first CD
Let
was
me
called.
Look it
but
up.
That's the one like Pretty Girls and Nike Boots was on. That's the one he had a song with Lady Gaga and Gucci.
Wale.
You never heard Pretty Girls?
Pretty Girl. Da, da, da. Yeah, I
like
have.
That's
yeah,
the first
yeah.
kind of stuff I knew about him. That and if anybody's played Saints Row 2, you know sometimes you got in the car and it was on a hip hop station. It had a song called Riding in That Black Junk. That was a Wale song that I knew from a video game. But then after that, 2010 came around and I think I was on X or something.
Foolerin.
This is when Falarin. Wale Falarin.
Yes, that's what you were talking about, though.
No, it wasn't.
That's not it?
That went on for Lauren. For Lauren came out when I was in college.
It did come out in 2012. Maybe it's not on the album. No, it's
It's Attention Deficit.
I was just about to say.
That's
yes,
what it is.
Yes,
I couldn't think
yes.
of it.
Yep,
but
yep.
after that, I think the first mixtape was a mixtape about nothing. But then in 2010, More About Nothing came out. So that's the first time I listened to him and he was on there. And I was like, man, who is this? Like the song that like
the mixtape About Nothing?
More About Nothing. It's the album or the mixtape that made me a Wale fan because Breakup Song is on there.
I became a fan.
Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Ambition. That's right. I listened to Attention Deficit a little bit, but Ambition was when I was like, we locked in.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think, but you know, the funny thing is like.
Lotus Flower Bomb, Please.
All them people are not that much older than me or you. So it's like the music is very relatable. He went to school and all this other stuff. And
but
like,
More About Nothing was good.
Friends and Strangers, The Breeze is Cool, Wiz Khalifa.
That did not come out in 2022.
What?
More About Nothing?
No, 2010.
Why do it say 22?
It got re-released.
Oh, I'm like, ain't no way.
It was a mixtape first.
Okay, it was.
Remember, people
used
to do mixtapes, yes. And mixtapes, yes. You didn't have to clear the sample.
Yep.
So you weren't necessarily making like money.
Song.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was on there. And you know what we should do? Because on Joe Budden Podcast, Ice said that Wale would beat Cole in the verses. And we probably should put together, and this probably could be Patreon, we should probably put together 10, 15 tracks of them back to back. I think you, would you say you're more of a Wale or a J. Cole fan?
I don't know. This album got me. I like them both. Don't make me pick. I know you like J. Cole, though.
I'll let you pick Wale. I've been to a J. Cole
concert.
Don't
make me pick him because I might lose. My laptop just died. I can use my phone.
Okay. Thank you.
No, I can use my phone.
Yeah, because I'm saying I got some, I think I got some USB-C somewhere. I got enough juice in here.
Let me just find it.
But,
okay, I got it.
But yeah, no, we can do that. Either that or.
I like that idea.
I think what eventually happened.
But we're not deciding on who picking who. We got to roll the dice.
That's fine. In 10 years, I don't see Wale and Cole going.
I don't want Cole going against nobody right
but
now.
I do see maybe Sean and Wale going. I think that's a better matchup.
Who's a good match for J. Cole?
Any of his contemporaries.
Like who?
Drake, Kendrick. All of them. Anybody who can really rap.
I personally think that him and Wale would be good because
I don't think so, because I think Wale got better lady records than him. Lotus Firebomb, That Way.
But the girl, don't get it twisted. The girlies love some Cole.
Yeah, I know that, but I'm talking about these songs. You got Matrimony, Wale.
You got Bad.
Bad. Like, if I go J. Cole, I got, Crooked Smile.
Crooked Smile.
I'm trying to think of his other one. I might have to go, Only Want to Give It to You with him and L. Varner. He got Planes with Jeremiah.
What's that? I just want to dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. What song is that?
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
What song is that?
I Only Want to Give It to You. Just another. That used to be my song right there.
Nah, facts.
I just couldn't think of it, how it started, but if I do the beat, I know it. It would be interesting, but it'll be tough because if it came into them records, if he just wanted to get at the ladies, it'll be a lot.
I think it would just be enjoyable. The people going to vote for whoever they're going to vote for. But I think it would just be a very enjoyable experience because they both are lyricists. And that is why,
But then I have to
I don't
want to
see him go up against Drake or Kendrick ever.
He probably...
But Kendrick would be good. I'm not going to lie. Kendrick would be good.
He have a better chance against Kendrick than Drake. Future got a better chance than J. Cole and Kendrick versus Drake than Kendrick and Cole.
I love Future.
So I don't know. It would be pretty cool. Years later, we will probably see stuff like that. But I mean, if it gets to aggressive rap, that's where Wale probably would lose.
Yeah.
And it depends on what mood somebody in. Because I mean, Wale can just come out to one of his hardest tracks. They got a song together. You got it.
Yeah.
Wale hit the better verse on that to me. So I don't know. Y'all let me know in the chat. Wale, Cole, did y'all like the new album? I like it.
It's on repeat for me. Since it came out.
I like Conundrum.
Conundrum, the first song got me. I'm like, okay. Cool. I like Fly Away. I like, let me pull it up.
I hate they got the samples because when the Pretty Wings samples come on, I'm thinking about the Steve Harvey Morning Show.
I like Conundrum, Where to Start. I like Power and Problems, Watching
he
Us.
He has some dope samples.
Tomorrow
on there.
Today is a banger. Fly Away, Like Us. I didn't get to Lonely yet, I don't think.
But
I don't think I made it.
I don't know. We'll do that. We may even have to record Rolling the Dice, and that might be something we could do it might not be on YouTube Live, but maybe Instagram, TikTok Live or something.
That'll
like
be
that.
Fun.
That'd be some fun to do. There was one.
You
well, we can talk
more?
About this. I actually have two, but I think this is the one that's a little bit more pressing. And I briefly want to talk about this, guys. Y'all know we talk about AI all the time, not Allen Iverson. By artificial intelligence and NVIDIA. NVIDIA's been in talk of the town. They stock just went up some more. NVIDIA's record $57 billion revenue and upbeat forecast quiets AI bubble talk. NVIDIA founder and CEO Jensen Huang struck a bullish tone in the company's third quarter earnings. And based on the company's results, There may be reason to. NVIDIA reported revenue of $57 billion in the third quarter, 62% higher compared to the same quarter last year. The company's net income on a GAAP basis was $32 billion, 65% higher year over year. Both revenue and profit results will beat Wall Street expectations. The revenue picture shows a company booming thanks largely to its data center business. Revenue generated by NVIDIA's data center business was a record $51.2 billion, up 25% from previous quarters and up 66% from a year ago. The remaining $5.8 billion in revenue came from NVIDIA's gaming business, with $4.2 billion followed by sales in professional visualization and automotive. NVIDIA CFO Colette Kress noted in a statement to shareholders its data center business has been fueled by an acceleration of computing, powerful AI models, and agentic applications during the company's Q3 call, Kress said in the past quarter. The company announced the AI factory and infrastructure projects amounting to an aggregate of 5 million GPUs. This demand spans every market, CSPs, sovereigns, modern builders, enterprises, and supercomputing centers, and includes multiple landmark buildouts. Blackwell Ultra, a GPU unveiled in March and available in several configurations, has been particularly strong and is now the leader within the company. Previous versions of the Blackwell architecture also saw continued strong demand, according to the company. Wong said sales of its Blackwell GPU chips are off the charts. Man, this is a lot. I'm just going to go to the end. Importantly, NVIDIA is forecasting more growth with a projected revenue of $65 billion in fourth quarter, helping push its share price up to more than 4% in after-hours trading. The upshot, at least in Wong's view, forget about the bubble, there's only growth. There's been a lot of talk about an AI bubble, Jensen said during the company's earnings call. From our vantage point, we see something very different. Man, I'm just thinking about the people who worked there that got stock options.
That part right there. Hopefully they cashing out on a little bit of something.
I mean, I think they did a stat like, let me see if Gemini knows. So I asked him, Gemini, how many people who work for NVIDIA are millionaires? And the AI overview said, according to June 2025, survey of over 3,000 employees, approximately 76 to 78% of NVIDIA employees are millionaires.
How many?
Out of 3,000 people, about 78%. And nearly half of those have a net worth exceeding $25 million.
Wow.
This wealth is largely due to the company's significant stock performance and equity-based compensation, which includes a stock purchase program that allows employees to buy shares at a discount. Mm. So this is the power of getting in the right company.
I was just about to say, choosing the company that you work for wisely.
That's why you got to go make friends. So this is slightly off topic. But we were watching, this is what we didn't talk about briefly. I don't know. Do you watch Landman?
No.
You should watch Landman with Billy Bob Thornton.
Where is it at?
It's on Paramount Plus. It's okay. Based on oil in West Texas, Permian and
like
stuff.
Like the
Odessa, all that. It's very good. It's very good. Second season started, and context was like the owner of the company died, so his wife was taking over operations. And she was overhearing some young ladies talking about, I think they were in Dallas or something, and she was overhearing them talking about the doctor's convention is next door. Now,
y'all the what?
Doctor's convention. Mm-hmm. So they was plotting on doctors they was going to get to so they can get them stuff bought for them. Now, y'all might be asking why I stay in this. This goes back into networking and knowing who works where and how to get in those doors back to that invisible market. It goes back into when the women were talking about they wanted to get these high-value men, and Kevin Samuels used to say, well, do you know where these people be at? Know where these people work at. Try to get in there. Like I said, they announce some new stuff. You study up on your AI. And this is something that we talked about with Bees. Go look at the people who work in AI now. Most of them have a master's, maybe even a doctorate. Most of them. Machine learning, AI, all that stuff. So that's all I want to say about that. And they was like, man, how you bring that up and this up? Hey, whoop-de-doo.
Okay. I have one more. So this is about the SolarWinds situation, which was a huge deal and it still is a big deal. And I'm happy it kind of worked out the way that it did. So the SolarWinds situation is essentially where the SEC kind of tried the SolarWinds CISO. And then they backed up like, actually, never mind. We're not going to do anything. We won't pursue. So the SEC finally dismissed their case against SolarWinds and their CISO, the one that was tied to the big 2020 Russian sunburst attack. this was a case that obviously everybody in cybersecurity was watching. If you're in school, you should know what happened. You should be able to talk about it in an interview. You should be able to bring it up. They might even ask you, especially if you're starting out, what happened, because it was such a big deal. Anyways, this was the first time the SEC tried to come for a CISO personally. They were basically accusing him of hiding vulnerabilities and misleading investors, like he was running a scam instead of trying to secure a massive, massive software supply chain. The gag is that a judge had already tossed out most of the charges earlier this year, so the SEC didn't have much left to stand on. Now, all sides are essentially saying, we're going to dismiss this with prejudice, meaning nothing is done, no rematch, no appeals. Now, SolarWinds, obviously, they were thrilled, but they basically said, y'all are trying to scare the CISOs, right, in the country to even manage companies log into their laptops. And they're not wrong. If this case did stick, CISOs everywhere would have been operating basically like they needed a lawyer before they were able to proceed and just handle daily operations. It was giving more of a blame the security leader for everything. And I don't think that that is fair. And that's really why I wanted to talk a little bit more about it. But just because the SEC dropped the case doesn't mean they won't spin the block. They still want transparency. They still want companies to stop playing games with breach disclosures. They want receipts. And they basically were just able to realize that this case wasn't the case that they'll be able to use to establish that precedent. So my take, leaders are already stressed, right? Burnout, lack of resources, shadow IT, executives who don't listen. You have a ton of things going on. And when you have the SEC coming in and trying to criminalize imperfect security, I have an issue with that because security isn't perfect. The goal of cybersecurity is not to stop everything.
You sure? Zero trust?
It's not to stop everything, but it is designed to make it more difficult, to make the attack cost more money, to make it take you longer to try to infiltrate our systems. And like we just said earlier, it's not if it will happen to you, but when. And I just don't, I would never want to be a CISO if I knew that that case actually stuck and now you have that precedent in place and now you're worried if something happens at your company, because things happen. But that doesn't negate the fact that we do have leaders out here that are lying to their investors and their shareholders and their stakeholders and whoever else, knowing that security isn't tight, knowing that they're inexperienced and they're painting a different picture on how well the company is actually doing. So I get it, but it's difficult.
Yeah, and honestly, he's not the only person.
He's not. He is not the only person at the company that's making these decisions.
No, I'm not saying that. He's not the only person at every company doing that.
Facts.
Everybody's withholding whatever happened until they can kind of, you know, I mean, think about it. Influence the stock prices. We got the guy from L3 Harris on the zero-day exploits.
Yep.
Like, come on, man.
I know he's happy and his family's happy.
Yeah. I would be, too. I mean, that's why, like, those jobs are stressful.
Imagine. Because it's not, obviously, it's his life, right? His livelihood. But it's not just him. It could affect things going forward as well. And that, to me, we don't even really have a good foundation here in the U.S. So to start there. Mm-hmm.
Did he countersue?
I don't know. I didn't look that up. I don't think so, though.
I would. Because I'm pretty sure he probably hadn't been working since then.
Jesus.
But them CISOs, they
getting paid.
They almost, now they're the people where, like, they contracts are contracts for real. Yeah. Like, severance, like, they probably getting their money paid
would
out.
Would you be a CISO?
Yeah, I'm already a CISO.
Period.
So, I actually want to get into, like, some fun stuff. Let's look at this conspiracy Apple digital ID thing.
Okay. That's supposed to be a new feature coming. Is it already out?
I think it's already out, but I just, you know, the premise of this, of just listen to this, because these people make me sick.
And so it begins, y'all. Like I said, people is not paying attention to the patterns of what the fuck is going on, fool. I know when people first seen this, they was just like, oh, how convenient is this? Bruh, we could just put this on our Apple wallet and we're good. On a first level surface, I know the hackers are looking like, oh yeah, we about to be fucking some shit up. But then on a greater level surface, you got to understand.
This music.
This is a part of the plan. Y'all don't see that everything is becoming digital? I know what happens when everything becomes digital, right? For my people that's not sleep, tell me in the comments down below. It's not just one answer. It's just crazy to me how fast people give up control without asking a single question, bro. They always spin it as convenience. It's just crazy to me, y'all. People been talking about this happening for years, bro. And the next thing is gonna be gone. You're gonna have something. Boom. And so it begins, y'all.
He ain't even saying
like
that.
I said.
Exactly. I kind of wasted time. I'm like, bro, you just yapping. Because
I'm not mad at it, but I do get the security concerns that are associated with it. But I'm also not angry with it. Pulling out your ID every time is a little irritating. But again, that's in-user behavior. I can get over it.
Do y'all passports have chips in them?
Yes, they do. That's how you can scan them.
No. But the funny thing is this guy, like other people's like, oh, that's how they going to do this and I'll do that. And like Benny was like, bro, we got cell phones. See, people are already tracking you.
That part.
And so, like, that
you
was
got one social media.
That was one of the, I thought he was going to say more. Like, I hadn't watched it. So I was like, yeah, that ain't nothing. I'd rather, let's see. This one might be good. I thought this was good when I bookmarked it a while back.
Corporate culture is white supremacy culture. And the 10th characteristic of white supremacy culture is fear of open conflict. Fear of open conflict has burned so many careers, it is not even funny. This is the most corporate thing I've ever heard. If you are harmed at your job, there is an unwritten expectation that you are just supposed to shut up and take it. This is what it looks like in practice, and this is from dismantlingracism.org. It says, people in power are scared of expressed conflict and try to ignore it or run from it. And notice, it's saying people in power, so the people that actually can do something about the conflict. When someone raises an issue that causes discomfort, the response is to blame the person for raising the issue rather than to look at the issue that is actually causing the problem. This is what is ruining so many people's careers, a characteristic of white supremacy, that fear of open conflict. There are so many people that have been relentless. Corporate culture is what...
We can eat that one up quickly. I feel like in our culture, we have... most times people don't have a hard time having a difficult conversation because we've been raised. So I feel like in the corporate world, I could see that because we're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And if you're not used to talking about things that are difficult, every difficult conversation
Now you got me.
Not like people think that conflict is all like combative or aggressive or a difficult conversation doesn't have to be any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you're uncomfortable doesn't mean that, it's unhealthy.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you see that a lot. I mean, you had the trope of not wanting to be the angry black woman or lashing out and kind of just taking it.
Or just being the only person that's speaking up.
Yeah, and then it's like it's a problem with you because you're not acquiescing. But like, nah, this stuff don't make sense. Why nobody saying nothing?
But I think it's a way to bring up your concerns, too.
I agree.
I think that if you're the person that always wants to say something, fine, so be it. But make sure you're doing that in a way to where they're not trying to perceive you,
Yeah, it's always, and the Bible said it's a time for everything. There's a time to do it. And that's why we go back
into... There's a time and a place for sure.
We get back into emotional intelligence. But I've also seen the white men not know how to talk to people.
I've literally had
a work experience years ago where we messed up on a report and the dude tried to talk to us like we was his kids.
I will say that I've seen a lot of people, all different type of people, lack social intelligence and the ability to read a room and to know when to give more or loosen it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it sucks when leadership knows that and they're not coaching that person on one bad apple can spoil the whole team, the whole bunch, So if you as a leader have somebody on your team that way and you're not coaching them on that behavior, you're not really doing yourself a good job. You're doing a disservice to yourself and your team, basically.
Yeah. But I think I'm going to try to follow her, see if she got any other stuff like that. Because it is different. Like, it's not made for everybody. It's really culture fit, all those different things. And it's like, come on, bro. Y'all culture is the BS and not really getting none done. Let's keep it a being here.
So corporate culture is...
That's not what I'm trying to do.
Low-key. Do we got voicemails?
Mm-hmm. Got... Yeah. Let me see. I think the last one I wanted to get into because...
I'm excited for those. I had a TikTok, but I'm trying to find it.
Okay. I'm going to just go to this one then. Thinking versus scrolling.
We're headed into the next phase of class warfare, a much more dangerous one. And if we don't make some dramatic changes quickly, it could be really hard to come back from. I started thinking about this when I heard Brené Brown talk about being in rooms with some of these tech billionaires and the way that they talk to normal people versus the way they talk to each other. When people come up and ask, "What can my kids do to be successful like you?" usually they're playing down the importance of college education, saying that it's expensive and unnecessary, telling them to have their kids study computer science online, become self-taught, take risks, start a business, learn AI. Yet when these guys are talking to each other about what they did to get where they are and how they're continuing to grow, they're talking about what they're reading. They're talking about the Stoics. They're talking about scholarship and growth and academia. And they're talking about internal work, what they're reading psychologically, what they're doing, how they're working on themselves in that way. And so two new classes are emerging versus just wealthy and poor. We're seeing the emergence of a thinking class and a scrolling class. A reading class and a streaming class, a writing class and an AI prompting class. Critical thinking is becoming a luxury of the rich and powerful, and this is by design. The guys that develop these technologies know what they do to our brains and how they limit our ability to think for ourselves over time. That's why when Steve Jobs was asked if his kids loved the iPad, he said they didn't have one. People don't understand that all of these things are connected. The censorship of public education, banning books, the war on colleges, and the rollout of these AI technologies that make it easier for us to not think our own thoughts. All of that is designed to make us more docile and easier to control. Forming your own opinions, deciding what you think and finding the evidence to back it up, that's a skill that can be lost very easily. Obviously, we can talk about that on a societal level, but let's stay on the individual for right now. What have you been reading lately? How often have you been letting AI think for you or speak for you? When was the last time you had a deep, intellectual conversation with a friend? If we don't prioritize these things, we will lose them. There's a billion-dollar industry dedicated to making sure we do. We're headed into
devil's advocate. I get what she's saying, but I feel like even to interact with AI, I don't think everybody that's using AI is letting it think for them because you have to tell it what you want it to do.
I disagree. People use ChatGPT like Google.
They do.
I don't think she's referring to the people that's actually prompting and solving problems.
That's what I'm talking
Her
about.
Her premise of everything started off with, like, you go in these rooms with these rich tech billionaires, and you say, hey, what can my kids be to do like you? And you ask them about should they go to school and this and that, and they lie to you. Meanwhile, their kids are going to school. It's all the stuff that we tell people. When they, all these people on Twitter saying, hey, don't go to school or get a trade. Yeah, because they're trying to make sure nobody has the skill set to do the white-collar jobs that's in control of things. And that's why they want you to go get a trade. And this is not a bash on trades. It's just telling you why they will push you to go do that so they can control you and control the way that they do things. And there's no opposition against them to do anything because they're not qualified. Mm-hmm. That's the main reason. And she, I like, too, she's like, when the last time you had a deep conversation?
No, that's, like, for real. Like, you know, I tell you all the time after we interview somebody, I'm like, oh, that was just so good. Like, they're so smart. I love that. But if you're not surrounding yourself with these type of people and you are surrounding yourself with people who will argue with you but didn't even do the research, you never read a bill, you never read an article, you never read a synopsis, you never watched a video, but you're arguing a point that is invalid.
While we are talking, this goes into the whole thing about associate's degrees and bachelor's and everything else that's been on TikTok. And
what is it? What's the fill me in?
I got to find the original thing. But people are trying to say, like, oh, they were kind of associates when they say multiple degrees. It's a technicality, but I don't really consider that. Like, associate's to me is like a diploma senior.
Oh, my gosh. Don't say that.
It is in the sense of when you stack it against having to go to school for 4 years to get a bachelor's.
But it's not this. It's not. You can't stack it against it. It's not a stack. It's a different thing. It's completely different.
Well, but no. When people say okay, when people normally say they have multiple degrees, are they not normally typically talking about a bachelor's, master's, maybe a doctorate?
I'm gonna tell you something that just happened the other day. I had asked someone. They were telling me they were in school, and I was like, "Oh, are you getting your bachelor's or your master's?" And they were like, "I'm getting my associate's." And they tried to crack a little joke, like, "Oh, I'm embarrassed." And I was like, "Don't be, because you're still going to class, you're still doing homework, you're still putting in the effort, you're still putting in the time. If that's something that you want to do, you can go back and do it." But I don't think it's that's like there's no comparison between a bachelor's and a master's, or a master's and a PhD, or if you go to get a JD. Like, they're all different.
Well, they're different, but I'm saying they have different levels of esteem. I think the
least, they do have different levels.
I think the
of
bare
esteem.
Minimum most people have more respect for is bachelor's, which is why
I agree
you
with
see
you.
See them on more job descriptions. Now this is,
but
not,
that's why people don't want to go to community college.
But community college is actually more so built for companies in the area, people that can go get specific skills to go do the jobs in the area. That's typically what we go to community college for. You can go to community college, get your hours up, and then go transfer to a 4 year.
I think that it's a culture thing, and we need to do better, because there are people that are getting these associate's degrees, and they are not weighted the same as if you had a bachelor's. 9 times out of 10, a recent grad I've never seen a recent graduate program that is open to associate's degree.
And that's the whole thing. I think the issue was that, like, yes, it's a accomplishment. To me, it's in the same vein of maybe going to get a certification.
Don't say that.
Not in a bad way.
It's not.
Because you still gotta study, you still gotta pass.
For 2 years.
Yeah.
You're not gonna do a certification for that long. You better not be.
You're right, but I'm just saying, what I'm saying based on markability. I mean, because you can say some people stack certs against degrees.
But, and I think that this is important. Let's stay here. I think this is important for people to think about this when they're pursuing that degree. Because I think that sometimes people think, oh, I'm gonna get this associate's and I'm just gonna break in. You're not wrong in saying that it is not weighted the same as a bachelor's. And 9 times out of 10, the things that you're going to apply for are going to say bachelor's degree, master's degree. And I'm following you. I'm following you.
Yeah. So I'm just focusing on, like, why it's not say the same. It's not like a knock. But the lady was like, the dude started saying, oh, I got multiple degrees. And they was started off with the associates. And her issue, I think everybody took issue with her because she was one of the people that probably make their degrees everything. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's just a piece of paper. We were talking about earlier, y'all could have it back. So I don't really care about it, but I say in the sense of, like, when you're talking education and when you like, and this is one part. Then you get into the next at the upper echelons of where you got your degree from.
Then okay.
So then people start saying, okay, yeah, I went to, like we talked about, I went to MIT, I went to Stanford, I went to NYU,
or I went to Yale.
Wherever you went to. So it did it, Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm. So it's just different things. Overall, I think it should stop. Like, don't bully people for getting associates. No, it is something. But in 2025.
But I think that people that are getting their associates, they should be aware that of a lot of things. One, it might be difficult depending on where you want to transfer to get those credits to transfer across smoothly. And two, just because you get that associate's degree doesn't mean your work is done. Because you might find, which typically is the case, that they might not accept that degree because this is for someone with a bachelor's or a master's or career experience. That's the only thing. It's like, think about if you're like, this is the cheaper route, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to go get my bachelor's, cool. But just make sure you understand what you're getting into and some of the limitations that could be present based on that.
Yeah, for sure. I did want to get into how companies judge leaders. However, I think we're going to hit this voicemail.
We only got one?
Yeah, I guess she didn't do it. It's too late for her now.
It is.
Unless you call on speakerphone.
I'm finna text her.
You ready?
Yeah.
As a experienced IT professional, with experience in various industries, what would you say is most important when pivoting to elevate your skill set? Is it the industry or the role that you're trying to obtain?
Hmm.
good question. Because everything would depend on what your skills are. Yeah. And I know who this is. Mm-hmm. I would say look into industry and what the role is.
Industry is big because someone in retail versus someone in healthcare versus someone in finance versus someone on the federal, like it, the industry absolutely matters.
If you were a person trying to get into IT and you worked at Target for years and you were able to go work for Walmart, Costco, Sam's Club, IT, you probably could do it because you understand on the back end how it works with everything. Or you worked in education, you worked in finance, you worked in banking, you worked in utilities and energy. You understand all those things. You have already the requisite skills you need to be competitive and do the job. So I would say research the industries and your current skills. Easy trick that I typically do when I'm doing a lot of calls is take the industry. So, for example, I know what work you do. So let's say, for instance, you were interested in getting into healthcare. You do healthcare and for the Boolean search and then put, like, system administration in quotes and see what comes up with that. See how your skills line up and then go from there. But as we talked about earlier, that's not always going to be enough now. You're going to have to find somebody to help you break down the barrier because your resume could be ironclad sometimes at this point and still the person's already picked.
Yep.
Like, still. So that's kind of how – that would be, like, my advice for you on that one.
I agree with you.
But, I mean, he has his master's in cyber. I think it's just been a rough stretch with how these companies do things and everything else. Yeah, we'll leave it with that. It is close. Next week will be Thanksgiving. Yeah.
What you ready to eat?
We don't really eat Thanksgiving food no more. We eat stuff like chicken wings and macaroni and cheese and ribs and burgers.
Sweet potato pie and cabbage.
Mm.
You know, I'm Presbyterian, so. Yeah.
Fried cabbage or what?
Either way, anyway. Any way it come. I like cabbage.
It don't matter to me. I might go. Look, they building a Waffle House down the street. If it was built right now, I'd probably go to Waffle House. Give me an All-Star special.
That's my favorite. But I never eat the waffle the same day. I eat it the next day.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a Waffle House right down there in Hebron. All the way down Hebron by 121. Yeah, guys. I don't know if we record next week. We may not. That's going to be up to her.
I'm off starting Thursday.
Me too. Also, we're drawing close to 500. I mean, no, 200. I'm sorry.
200.
We're going to have five episodes after this.
What we 200. Doing?
I don't
what
know
we
yet.
Doing?
I seen a karaoke spot in Addison.
I think I sent it to you. It's real, real big.
I don't know if it's big, but
I think there. The one I sent to you is huge.
Yeah. I want to do something like karaoke, escape the room, maybe
karaoke.
Maybe eat somewhere. Like, we're like, so, you know, everything over
everything
there.
Everything would, anywhere West over here.
Legacy Shops of Legacy.
Yeah,
we could.
Perfect.
Like, people can come and then we go do some stuff.
So, were we thinking before the end of the year?
It depends. It depends on.
We should top it off in the beginning of the year.
We can. I mean, like I said, it really just depends, especially.
Well, we got a lot of weeks left.
We'll see. We'll definitely see. Like I said, we'll put out the memos. If you're interested to come kick it with us, come fly in town. And
that's why I think we should wait till January, after the holidays.
We could. I mean, we always could do another one. Like I said, there's some stuff in the works that's going to come out, and that's really when we're going to get the moving and shaking.
Moving and grooving.
But I appreciate you. I appreciate y'all for tuning in with us, man. It's been another episode of Textual Talk. I'm HD.
And I'm Cyber Shorty.
Until next time, let's stay textual and we out. Peace.